Hey everyone, and welcome to the second ever episode of the Seriously Risky Business Podcast. This is the podcast we do that is based on the Seriously Risky Business newsletter, which is written for people who work in government and policy mostly, you know. So if you're interested in those big picture cyber topics, we have you covered. Seriously Risky Business, of course, is written by Tom Uren, who's joining me now. And we also have a special guest, Dmitry Alperovich, the founder of, or co-founder of CrowdStrike, turned geopolitical think tank guy. He now runs the Silverado Policy Accelerator. Guys, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Pat.
I should mention too that this podcast and the newsletter are made possible thanks to support from the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative, as well as some sponsorships from the likes of Proofpoint, Ost Cyber, and CyberCX. So yeah, look, we've got a few things to talk about this week, and I suppose the big story of the week, and it's something that we covered in the main Risky Business podcast as well, albeit from a slightly different angle, are these attacks from people pretending to be hacktivists against Iranian steel mills. Now, these attacks apparently caused some physical damage. So, you know, sparks literally flying, which is something we've all been waiting for so many years in this industry. But I think one of the most interesting features of all of this, like it's pretty obviously an Israeli government hack or campaign. But I think one of the interesting things that you've noticed here, Tom, is that it seems that these attackers are really trying to telegraph that they're sticking to established norms of responsible behavior in cyberspace, even though they're doing something destructive.
Yeah. So I spoke to Hamid Kashfi. Apologies if I've murdered his name. He's been tracking that group because he's just got a special interest in Iran and cyber operations there. And so for this particular steel attack, they compromised Telegram channels beforehand and sent warnings to make sure no one was injured. In other attacks that they've done, they've sent early warnings. So they disrupted gas stations, the sort of way you pay for fuel in Iran, and they sent warnings to particular emergency service commanders. So people like ambulances and emergency services wouldn't be affected by fuel shortages.
I mean, that I found that part really interesting, which is that before they're going to run an attack that disrupts fuel supply, they actually warned emergency services that they needed to prepare for this thing, right? Like that's not normally something a typical hacktivist would think to do.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was really leapt out to me. Another thing he said in that particular case is that they reported vulnerabilities to the vendors as well. So that's, again, something that I don't know that I've seen hacktivists do. So there's this track record. Oh,
and by the way, any offense team, right, is not necessarily interested in revealing their tradecraft and potentially shutting it down, either by notifying some of the victims in advance or revealing vulnerabilities. I mean, it's a pretty ballsy maneuver.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's unusual to have a hacktivist group with a vulnerabilities equities process. Let's put it that way.
And he also said that in particular the gas station hack, that they had really comprehensive access. They could have done way more, but they chose to be restrained, I guess. So this group, actually, there's a history back to 2019 where they were operating in Syria and hitting quite precisely targeted Iranian-linked groups. So probably the most interesting one is that they attacked Cham Wings, which was an airline used by the IRGC, or the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And it was included ferrying around General Soleimani, their head, who was subsequently assassinated after he'd caught a Cham Wings flight to Baghdad airport.
Yeah, like he literally just got off the plane when he got vaped, right?
Yeah, I think he was maybe still in the airport. He was in a car leaving the airport when he was struck by a drone strike. And then there's other companies that the previous incarnation of this group has struck. A trading company accused of being dealing with the Quds Force, which is a wing of the IRGC. And an oil transport company that had links with Hezbollah or did business with Hezbollah. So there's this long history of precisely targeted attacks that are also publicly purporting to be very responsible.
Yeah, yeah. So this is where it gets super interesting. And I mean, a lot of this kicked up after there were some attacks allegedly by Iranian operators against water infrastructure in Israel, right? So this does seem like a, you know, frankly, a bit of an overkill response to that. But look, this is so clearly the work of the Israeli government. And I got to ask you, Dimitri, like, if it's that clear, why bother with the extremely weak subterfuge in the first place, claiming that this is activists? Why on earth even keep up the ruse when everyone can see through it?
Yeah, by the way, I found it really interesting that the word for sparrow, this group is calling itself predatory sparrow, in Israel is, I believe, drawer. I'm not a Hebrew speaker, so apologies if I'm mispronouncing it, but it also means freedom in Israel. So it's quite interesting that they named the groom in Hebrew.
Jeez, what a coincidence. But this, you know, this still feeds into you know, the question that I'm asking you, yeah, which is, when it's so obvious, why bother? Why not just say, yeah, we done it?
Well, it actually fits into their modus of operandi of being opaque about all of the operations, right? They never take credit for assassinations that everyone believes they're doing in Iran of nuclear scientists and military personnel, in part because they don't want to necessarily very publicly stick it in the Iranian faces, because that would trigger a retaliation, right? When you slap someone in the face in public like that, the Iranians would have no choice but to respond. And what the Israelis are hoping for is that while the Iranians may ultimately respond to some of these operations, they won't respond as aggressively as they might have if there was actual clear-cut attribution here and it wasn't a little bit opaque. I mean, this has been Israeli strategy in many areas. If you look at their alleged nuclear program in Israel, everyone believes that they, of course, have nuclear weapons. They've never acknowledged it. Precisely because they don't want to stick it in people's faces and create an impetus for other states to pursue nuclear weapons programs in the region.
See, for me, this is one area where the sort of retail politics and the geopolitics are kind of linked, right? Because if you did have Israel saying, yeah, it was us in your face, like, that is actually going to piss off your average Iranian. You know what I mean? And maybe force the government to act. Do you see that, Tom, as a bit of a dynamic here, that the perception of the average person is something that needs to be steered a little bit in the countries of your adversaries? You know, you don't want to be insulting their national pride and getting them to demand that their government does some sort of retaliation. Do you think that is a factor here?
Yeah, that kind of makes sense to me. It struck me as I was writing the piece that it feels like, by being to some degree quite transparent, they're trying to have their cake and eat it as well. Like, they're trying to project the values or appear to be responsible, appear like a state without actually saying that they are a state. So it's...
Well, I mean, that's effective if you want to signal to your, you know, the government of your enemy or your adversary while not rubbing it in the population's face.
Yeah, exactly. Place, and right? It's a case of implausible deniability. And I think it works in this instance.
Well, we just changed a headline on the newsletter because it hasn't gone out yet. So implausible deniability absolutely has to be the headline on that one. Look, that wraps that one up. Anyone who's interested in some more details can go and check out this week's Seriously Risky Business newsletter. Tom, you did a fantastic job writing that one up. It's a fascinating read. One thing we wanted to quickly mention, but it is a thing that we covered in the main Risky Business podcast, which is that in Israel, scalper bots, like sneaker freaker bots, these are the bots that people would use to like snag reservations for purchasing things like limited edition sneakers and things like that. People are using similar style bots to now scalp appointments with government services. So if you want to go get like your passport renewed in Israel or whatever, you have to go and buy an appointment from one of these scalpers for $100. And moral of the story, as you got to, and you interviewed Sam Crowther, who's the founder of Casada, which is a bot mitigation company based, originally from here in Australia. You know, he basically said, look, this is just something that governments need to think about now because it is something that could happen to them. But last week, Tom, you and I spoke about TikTok and about the BuzzFeed reporting that alleged that the company had very poor control over how its data actually, you know, where its data actually went, where its user data actually went. And that reporting from BuzzFeed seems to have stimulated a bit of a response from an FCC commissioner.
Yeah, so Brendan Carr described TikTok as a a wolf in sheep's clothing, and he's asked both Apple and Google to ban it from their app stores.
Which is funny because the FCC doesn't actually regulate app stores, right?
Yeah. So Carr's somewhat hawkish, I would describe him, about
you think?
China, just perhaps, about China-linked companies. I've quoted him before in the newsletter because he described DJI as Huawei with wings, which I thought
was so
just,
quotable.
That was just great. And when he published a letter on Twitter, and I just scoured it for something quite as good, but not quite this time. The thrust of the piece last week was that we don't know whether TikTok, or there's no agreement on whether TikTok is a problem because of the data it holds or because of the influence it may have across the public. And he focused entirely on the data, which the expert Fergus Ryan that I spoke to last week, he described the data as a red herring. So it's another example of disagreement about what the actual problem is.
And I will admit to being quite surprised when I saw it, because he posted this letter into a tweet, as you mentioned, and it went, you know, viral and everyone's freaking out. But then we realized, well, actually, he's a Republican on an agency controlled by Democrats, and the FCC doesn't have regulatory authority there anyway. So it is, massive storm in a teacup, but I thought it was worth mentioning. Now, Dimitri, one of the reasons we asked you to be a part of this particular discussion on Seriously Risky Business is because Mandiant and Aspi, and I understand Tom mentioned this to me actually, Tom formerly worked at Aspi, and apparently they'd been tracking this same thing for a while, but Mandiant just beat them to the punch with their report. Both of those organizations had been tracking a Chinese disinformation campaign. And to me, this is a really, really interesting campaign. What they were trying to do with it, it wasn't super effective, but we'll get to that. What they were trying to do is stoke environmental protests against rare earth mining in countries outside of China. Now, of course, rare earth minerals are a strategic edge for China because they produce most of them. And by the looks of this campaign, they don't want mines spinning up in other countries to compete with them. So this is a very tightly targeted disinformation campaign. Mostly when you see disinformation campaigns out of places like China and Russia, they tend to have a broad objective, like fomenting dissent generally, or, you know, just stirring shit up, basically. But in this case, it's a tactical disinformation campaign. Dimitri, what did you think of this?
I think this absolutely is really, really fascinating. And in fact, we've seen the Chinese over the last few years really ramp up the disinformation game. It's still very basic compared to what we've seen from the Russians. And Mandiant has done really some great coverage on this. Sandra Joyce, their head of intelligence, and I did a presentation at RSA where she talked about some of the campaigns that we have seen on COVID and trying to tap into the sentiment about the attacks on Chinese and other Asian Pacific people in America that we've been seeing in the last couple of years.
That's a great example of just broad disinformation designed to harm Chinese, America generally. Yeah,
right. But it fits into the Chinese narrative of trying to push their agenda, trying to push their worldview. But you're right. This is very, very strategic. Rare earths are one of the critical levers that they have to head back at us and the rest of the world, because obviously we have a huge dependency on rare earths and other critical materials pretty much in every technology that we have, from batteries and electric cars and windmills and everything else. And the Chinese right now are the primary refiners. There are a few other countries, but they have the vast majority of the market there. And they want to keep it that way. And in the last couple of years, there have been a critical realization on the part of the United States and many other countries that we can't allow Chinese to keep this monopoly, that this is very dangerous, particularly when we've seen them use this as a weapon against the Japanese about a decade ago. So there's a growing interest on the part of governments to invest in both mining and processing of these materials. And it is very environmentally precarious. So there's already some domestic opposition to this on the environmental grounds, and they're tapping into it.
Well, the best disinformation always has that kernel of truth, right?
Well, and that's a critical point, because if it doesn't have that kernel of truth, it just doesn't work. And we're seeing that with the Russians right now in Ukraine, where they're trying to push out narratives to the Ukrainians that Poland is about to invade them. And of course, no one is buying that, and it's just falling flat. But something like this can really have an effect. It doesn't appear to have had this at this point, because I think the Chinese are still very nascent in their disinformation operations. But if they get their act together, this can really be problematic.
That seems to be about where Tom landed on this as well. And Tom, I want to bring you into the discussion now, because not only, you know, Dimitri mentioned something that you mentioned in that item that you wrote, which was that China did actually ban the sale of rare earth minerals to Japan based on some, you know, maritime dispute or something, in response to some maritime dispute. But China also threatened to halt sales of rare earth minerals to the United States as well. And this is something that could have quite an impact, you know, like this is a genuine source of power for China, isn't it?
Yeah. So Dimitri stepped through all the uses of rare earths, well, not all of them, but some of them. And the Chinese government actually has form in banning, not banning, the import and export of different goods at times. So they've definitely got that in their toolkit. That's something they do pretty much all the time. Now, the campaign as a whole didn't appear to be effective, but it did get engagement from real people, and some of those people were investors and things like that. So you don't necessarily have to have a huge reach to reach a few influential people. But again, it's the trajectory of the campaign and the way that they do it. They don't seem to have a lot of success, but they continue to do it and they improve over time. So what we want is for these kinds of campaigns to remain ineffective. We're probably not going to stop them from trying and trying and trying, but it is an arms race where the techniques they use will improve, and we need to keep staying on top of it. And I think it being ineffective or appearing ineffective right now is no reason to take our eye off the ball.
One thing that I think is interesting about all of this, and the reason that I asked Dimitri to join us, is because, rare earth minerals is an area that I know, Dimitri, you've invested a lot of time and effort into. One thing I find interesting is that China has been like such an asshole about this, that there's all of this work going into re-engineering things to not make use of these materials. And you look at the trends in car batteries, for example, you know, EV batteries, they're all going going LFP, because they're a little bit heavier, a little bit less efficient, but they last longer and you can make them out of really common stuff. And meanwhile, there's a lot of American investment in places like here in Australia in developing some of this mining. So, you know, China using this as a lever is why there's investment going to other places, and why people are working quite hard to move away from being so dependent on these materials.
But you know, it's not just rare earths, and you're absolutely right that there's attempts to rework around it. We'll see if it spreads to other industries. Of course, we have numerous dependencies across a huge number of technologies and rare earths, but it's also about things like nickel and lithium and other things that you can't work around. What the Chinese are doing, of course, are buying up mines in places like Africa and elsewhere in order to get a lock on all of these materials. So just watch them expand way beyond rare earths and try to lock up critical minerals that we can't live without.
Yeah, it's interesting watching China kind of roll like America in the bad old days, when it would support all sorts of awful regimes to get the stuff in the ground, right? Like it has shades of bad America, their current policies.
I mean, it is colonialism straight out. Not only are they buying up these materials, but they're importing Chinese labor to get them out, not even supporting employment from the local populations.
Now, look, the last thing we'll just mention is because it is very much related. Microsoft put out a report. You just alluded to it, actually. Microsoft put out a report on Russian disinformation pertaining to the Ukraine war. I didn't read it. I'm sorry. So I'm just going to have to ask you, Dimitri, because I know it's something you track. And also then you, Tom, you know, what the interesting findings were.
Well, I thought one of the interesting findings, and we've been seeing this, is that while the disinformation campaigns from the Russians vis-a-vis the West have not worked, because obviously they're confronting a mindset on the part of many in the West that this is a war of aggression, that the Russians are committing war crimes, so they're not going to be sympathetic to their case. Their attempts to convince Ukrainians that what they should really be afraid of is foreign troops from Poland, not Russia, invading their country. Obviously, that's not working. But their focus on the global South countries, trying to get countries like India and China and others around the world that don't really have a stake in this fight and just want to get food prices under control so that they don't starve, and energy prices lower, etc. There, it's really working. And the messaging that they're putting out to those countries and those populations is that this is just U.S. aggression, NATO aggression against Russia, that Ukraine is just used as a proxy. by the United States, and people are believing it in huge numbers. And you can see that in the UN votes, right? When there was a UN vote to condemn the Russian invasion, something like 140 countries were voted with us, but I believe about 30 or so abstained. And when you look at the population of those 30 countries, it's almost half the world. It's a lot of people that were represented, obviously in many cases, authoritarian regimes in those countries, but not always. And that's something to watch. I mean, the fact that they got both India and Pakistan that never agree on anything to abstain from this resolution tells you that they're having effect.
Yeah. Tom, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I 100% agree with Dimitri that there's a lot of the time it seems like disinformation can be useless or counterproductive. And usually when that's the case, you're not the real target of that disinformation. Like my attitudes towards Russia over the Ukraine war were never up for grabs. But there is this huge population where it is up for grabs. And we're moving towards a world where there's where it's not dominated by Western powers like Australia and the US. Well, maybe I should say like the US and Australia. Yeah. where having a story to tell to those people is really important. And both Russia and China are investing in the apparatus to tell a story that resonates with those people. And I don't think we are.
I tell you what, the pandemic, and this is kind of a little bit off topic, but bear with me. The pandemic taught me something. And watching smart people, very smart people, fall into conspiracy rabbit holes during the pandemic made me understand, and I finally found the words to express it, it made me understand that intelligence and judgment are different traits. So that's how this stuff can work, is you can even take a smart person who's got poor judgment and show them this stuff and they will absolutely fall for it. Whereas you take someone who's maybe not educated, maybe not even that smart, they look at it and they just scoff and say, bullshit, right? And it's because it's almost like a gut feel judgment sort of thing. And it's, I don't think it's real. I think it's something kind of innate.
I find it interesting that it took you a pandemic to realize this when you spend so much of your career in cybersecurity, where it's evident every single day when very, very smart people fall for the dumbest phishing attacks.
Dimitri Oparovich, thank you so much for joining us as a special guest on the second ever episode of Seriously Risky Biz. I hope you'll do it again. And Tom Uren, great work as usual on this week's newsletter, and thanks for the discussion. Appreciate it. Thanks to both of you.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Pat.